Welcome to What a Ride with Rupert Guinness and Aaron Essley. I'm Aaron Essley.
And I'm Rupert Guinness.
And we are live coming to you from the Lord Dudley Hotel here in Sydney, Australia. Rup, always a pleasure to see you, mate. It's been a long week without you.
It's been a long week, but an exciting week.
Tell me, what's been going on?
Well, we've seen the end of the end of the Dauphiné.
Yep.
We've seen the end of the Tour de Suisse, where you've basically got onto the cusp, on the edge of the Tour de France.
We are so close to the Tour de France. You can almost smell it.
Exactly, in the rosé. Actually, I should also, that we talk about races, the Route du Sud as well, which Alberto Contador won. You know, so there's three big races there that have been fought and won and lost.
Absolutely. You know, but we're going to get into that in a little bit of try as well. We're going to talk to you a bit about that, but first, we're going to talk a bit about We Are What a Ride and just exactly what we are to remind the listeners. We are coming to you live from the Lord Dudley, as we mentioned. We are on the Australian Broadcast Media Network. We're 36 FM stations, 200 digital, and available on download to your smartphone via iTunes. Rupert, you've been around for quite a while. You've been covering rugby, rowing, sailing, cycling, triathlon for almost 30 years.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great job being a sports journo, really, when you think about it. Just when you just say that, Aaron, you know, it just makes you realize, you know,
it's a good gig.
It's a good gig. The great thing about covering sport is it's about positive drive, you know, forward, you know, athletes and teams trying to achieve the best and do what they can. Even under extenuating circumstances, the big story may not always be the winning story. It can be, I hate to say the losing story, but it can be the team that doesn't win.
Looking back at a 30-year career, are there special moments? They'd have to be. Now, again, for over 30 years, are there special moments in your career that just really stand out?
Oh, dude, that's a hard one. I mean, I have to say, even though I've, you know, with all the cycling events I've covered, and they've been fantastic events for, or memorable events for good and bad reasons, which is all those books you mentioned about, but also some of the poignant moments and significant moments have been I still rate the 2007 Rugby World Cup in France as a great period of my life, even though the Wallabies absolutely stank. You know, actually, rugby stack, the game that was played in that whole tournament really wasn't a positive game of rugby.
So what made that year so special?
It was more the atmosphere, the ambiance, as they say in France, of the cup, and just the chance to be able to experience another sport apart from cycling, which has been so close to my heart, like the Tour de France, obviously. So I go to France, the Tour de France, to experience the Tour de France in a cycling environment. But then to see and experience France from a rugby point of view, and actually it's opened my eyes very widely to how great rugby in France is. And hence, I've had interest in the top 14, the French Championship competition. Since then, I've written a book on George Smith, the former Wallaby player, who could be a current rugby player for the World Cup this year in 2015 because of the new Australian Rugby Union laws. And at that time, he was playing for Toulon in France. So I got to speak with him and experience French rugby in his environment, which I found an environment which I was attached to. But it was from a rugby point of view, it was a new point of view. And I really just, you know, well, I've got a big rap for French, well, for French sport anyway.
Well, you lived in France.
I lived in France.
How many years?
I was 9 years in total. Four of those years were in Belgium.
And you were working for Belenews at the time?
Yes, working for Belenews. I originally went over there for Winning Magazine, which was then published in Brussels in Belgium. And I was the editor of the English-speaking edition. And I was the European correspondent for the American edition. And they had two editions. It was pretty amazing when you think of it those days. Two editions of one English-speaking magazine. This is going back in the 80s. And at that point in time, I think there was probably a couple of other magazines existed, like I think there was Cycling International. But whatever way, here in Australia, you'd get those magazines 6 months later, at best. You know, it was great. And they had beautiful photos. And I always dreamed. I was working at News Limited at the time, and I was used to dream of what a job that would be.
Now, for the record, you're not working at News Limited now.
No, I'm working for Fairfax.
And you're not working for Villanews now.
I'm not working for... Okay, we've moved on, haven't we?
Yeah, just to clarify this thing.
We're in 2015. 15.
Yeah, absolutely.
Working for Fairfax and about to go to the Tour de France.
Absolutely. And yeah. Of course, you work for Cycling News as a correspondent as well.
Yeah.
That being said, I work for Velo News now, and I used to work for Cycling News. So we've flip-flopped a bit there. You know, you talk about how slow the communication was back in the day, and we're talking the 80s. One thing that was significant during that time period was one Australian, Phil Anderson, who, and this is a relevant story not just to Australians, but to every non-European, as he became the first non-European to ever don the Maillot Jaune.
Yeah. Aaron,
you were there.
Yeah, I mean, Aaron, it was what you're saying is exactly right. I mean, it's fantastic. We've seen Cadel Evans win the 2011 Tour de France. We saw his journey towards that, the highs and the lows. We've seen, we've all celebrated the stage wins by Australian riders and different teams in the Tour de France and in other races as well. And also Orica Green Edge, Australia's first World Tour team. Well, Australia's first team in the Tour de France, and which has been fantastic stories, and they still are fantastic stories that are evolving. But the more those stories evolve, I still think that the imprint that someone like Phil Anderson left on the sport in contemporary Australian cycling, notwithstanding there was a lot of great riders who rode in Europe before Phil, but Phil Anderson was very much in the contemporary Formula, he was the pioneer, and what he did back in the early 80s, and not just winning, not just claiming the yellow jersey for the first time by an Australian in 1981, is the way he raced in the classics. He attacked in the classics. He attacked in the tours. He did this and that. And I still remember when Richie Porte finished seventh in the 2010 Giro, I rang him for an opinion, and his recollection, not being disrespectful to Richie Porte's achievement, but when he raced the Giro, he just used to race it for, he didn't even think of the general classification, but Phil actually finished eighth one year without actually thinking of it, which may reflect a change of the significance of how people race.
Yeah, you know, we look at the past year, if you go back the previous season, to a Colombian, Nairo Quintana, and what he was able to accomplish at the Giro d'Italia, and how much fanfare that came from being the first Colombian to do so. What would Phil Anderson, the accomplishment that he created, that he achieved back almost 30 years ago, if not more, what would the social media buzz be about Phil Anderson?
Wow, you could think of that. The closest it would be, funny you mention that, because at the same sort of era, you had the first Colombian team that arrived in the Tour de France, Café de Colombia. It had riders like Lucho Herrera. And the big imprint that the Colombians had on that, not just obviously their performance, but they came with these Colombian radio reporters who just were sitting on the finish line with mics on their hand, and they were calling pedal stroke for pedal stroke live to Colombia. And another event of the Tour de France was being in the media, standing in the media section, and watching these Colombian radio reporters actually just give their live commentary. No one could understand it. Now, I don't mean that flippantly either, because obviously I don't understand Spanish, but it was absolutely exciting to hear them commentate, let alone watch the race unfold. So I think that was probably the closest to live, immediate,
global
thing, because that was the gateway to another frontier of reportage of the Tour de France. Live global reportage was going to Colombia, and that was seen as a new frontier. And so, from an English speaking point of view, at that point it wasn't live coverage, so it was still not until.
Well, the news came over by boat.
Literally, because magazines came over. And then, obviously, fortunately, SBS got on board and started doing their 30-minute highlight packages, which was obviously massively important for Australia, and then I think also for the broader stream of coverage, in the English-speaking world. But I think the two organisers, ASO, obviously realised that the Tour de France is a brand they've got to globalise. But I still think the Colombians have a huge tick to them for not just, they did start the excitement of globalized Tour de France coverage, even though the Americans did come in with their big crews and, you know, the big film crews, and they did that with, you know, the rise of Greg LeMond.
But of course, and even the rise of Greg LeMond, though, came a few years after Phil Anderson. As a matter of fact, Greg LeMond tributes his success to Phil Anderson opening that door.
Well, what a lot of people don't realize is Phil and Greg were very much, you know, they were peas in the pod when their career started. Okay, Greg might have shown, actually, I wouldn't say shown more promise, but I guess he showed more promises as a probable Tour de France contender than Phil did, even though Phil was finishing fifth. He got two fifths, but Greg was, you know, straight away up there in fourth and, you know, third and stuff. And so he was, you know, straight away seen as that. But one of the interesting anecdotes I remember is talking to Phil early in his career was how when he was riding for Peugeot, the French team Peugeot, and all the contracts were in French. And basically, in that day and age, Phil didn't understand a lot of French at that time. And you can imagine when there's not a lot of English-speaking riders, Greg was there, two English-speaking riders amongst in the new world. And he didn't really understand the contract. He actually got a lawyer who happened to work in Formula One car racing to have a look at his contract, just to check if this is okay. At the time, Phil was married with somebody, with his wife Anne, from America, who, I mean, I think, I'd assume the two of them thought it was best to get someone else to look at this contract. Sure. Amazingly, that manager said, this contract is worth a piece of shit. Beep, beep, beep. Can we put the beep?
We can.
But, yeah, really, you know, like, really, it was just worthless. And so he came back and replied and said, you know, the lawyer, the Formula One manager said, do changes. Suddenly became a major headline in the French paper, like Aussie cyclist seeks Formula One manager to seek mega multi-franc, you know, deal.
So is the media painting him as a bad guy?
I wouldn't say the bad guy, but it certainly is the shock guy, as a shock cock. The shock jock.
Absolutely.
We can have a beat there.
Yeah, we can.
We can have a beat there.
This is live radio, people.
Certainly that way, because I mean, it really was confrontational. Yeah. It was a confrontation of cultures. And all Phil was just wanting was a fair cut, you know. And get back to the Greg LeMond angle, Greg obviously saw that too. And, you know, Greg was very much a driver in trying to create bigger wage or better wages and better circumstances, not just for English-speaking riders, but for riders generally. You know, this is one of the great things about American influence in cycling was just a push for, you know, better rights, better wages, better contracts. You know, that was Greg's thinking. I mean, Phil came in really just, you know, by himself, just trying to cut a better deal. But they were two good mates.
That's an amazing story. You know, the fact is that he did really pave that way for Greg, and as being an American journalist, really putting that door that he opened for Greg LeMond really opened the door for cycling in the U.S. completely. I remember talking to Philippe Bouvet from L'Equipe, and him saying that probably that was that Greg's winning the Tour de France was one of the biggest moments in cycling globally, because it did open that door to North America. And again, that makes a lot of sense when you see Greg attribute his win and his opportunity to Phil Anderson, which I think we would both agree probably still doesn't get as much respect and due as he should deserve.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Philippe, you know, I know you got some good precious time with Philippe when he was out here in Australia, which would have been time. I wish I was at that dinner table when you guys were together, but
had a whole week with him.
Yeah. Oh. I mean, I've known Philippe Bouvet for a number of years, and one thing actually I forgot to tell you, Aaron. I saw him he was at the Giro.
This last year, right?
This last year. And you know what? He had that same vibrant love of cycling back. And I was actually really heartened to see Philippe there enjoying cycling game. I'm not saying he wasn't enjoying it, but obviously, you know, the sport's gone through a tumultuous period for everybody for a number of years, number of reasons. And there's certain periods that, you know, one person may be dipping out a bit if they're not faith or love, but they're sort of dipping out and then coming back and finding it again. And I saw Philippe in the Giro, and he I could see that little twinkle in his eye again. And it's really important that there are long-standing journalists who have weathered the storm, for better or for worse. I'm not just saying this for myself. I just think it's important there's still people there who can still come back and have a face in the sport and deliver a message. And whatever that message is, it's a message.
No, absolutely.
Everybody else can, people who are new to the sport can still learn from it.
Absolutely. Of course, that goes back to yourself. One Andrew Hood that we had on last week, who replaced you at Velo News at the time when you left. Yeah, absolutely. And we had
replacement. Yeah, I wasn't made.
Well, there you go. No, exactly. And obviously, we had Andrew Hood, Euro Hoodie, at Euro Hoodie on last week. And then I can't mention 1986 and Greg LeMond and the Tour de France without mentioning another team that obviously Greg wasn't a part of. But Team 7-Eleven, which is near and dear to my heart. You had a great Davis Finney, Taylor Finney's dad, Chris Carmichael, and of course, I think one of the best athletes of all time, Eric Heiden, who had made the transition from cycling to pro cycling from speed skating, where he had won 5 Olympic gold medals at Lake Placid in 1980. Unbelievable athlete to make that transition. And from what I understand, the only athlete that is in both the U.S. Pro Ice Skating Hall of Fame and Cycling Hall of Fame.
I mean, Eric Heiden. I mean, what amazes me about Eric Heiden, like, you knew him as an American, and he was, I mean, obviously a phenomenal star. I remember when he was riding the 7-Eleven, and he was riding just to finish the Tour de France, for example. What amazed me was how a guy who had been such a, you know, he had all these gold medals hanging around him, metaphorically speaking, and then he's just so embraced the role of just trying to do the best he could every day. And he was a big bloke, and he was riding the Tour de France.
His legs were literally the size of tree trunks, and they were massive. They were quite comparable to some of the better sprinters in the pro peloton now. He was a massive individual, an amazing guy, who now is a chiropractor, successful chiropractor, in Salt Lake City, I believe Salt Lake, but in Utah, and he's one of the ambassadors for the successful Tour of Utah that's gone quite well in the last couple of years.
Oh, well, there we go. I mean, it's great that he's, I'm not surprised he's still involved in this sport. I mean, that's his nature, really, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And, I remember as a journalist, so I'm just pausing a little bit, because I just remember as a journalist trying to think, you know, you were trying to get him to come out with some gold, because he had so much gold, as I said, around his neck. He would never give gold. But I realised pretty quickly, he's probably the sort of athlete you just need to observe and watch and appreciate the moment.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then, in his own way, he would give you the recognition by you just sort of recognising that, you know, respecting his position as not being a star in a cycling team. I think he respected that better than you trying to come up to him and say, you know, hey, mate, you're Olympic, 5-time Olympic gold medalist.
Of course, and we'll leave it at this before we go to commercial break, but, you know, when he won those 5 gold medals in 1980, I was 8 years old. And they say, never meet your heroes, your childhood heroes. And I can tell you, he lived up to it. In every way, he is an Olympic hero.
Well, I reckon we can get him on the show sometime.
Yeah, we should.
We'll
try to get you on the show.
If we don't, we'll come up with different impersonations.
Absolutely.
I am Eric Heiden, Harold.
Absolutely.
That is so nice in impersonation.
Well, what would you rather do? Would you rather go on a bike ride with him? Or a lap around the ring?
Good call. You know what?
I'd like to see you on the skating rink, the ice rink.
I have been on the skating rink. I have done it twice. I did pirouettes and...
As you would.
Sorry, I'm almost dreaming.
Yeah, and we'll have actually photos of these on Rupert Guinness's Twitter account, at Rupert Guinness, which he is currently not using. We'll have to catch back up more with Rupert's skating prowess, and obviously more with What a Ride with Rupert Guinness and Aaron Astley. We're coming back. We'll talk more cycling. We've got triathlon on deck. Even a potential breaking story that may happen. By the time you listen to this, the story would have already broken, unfortunately, but we're on top of it first. We'll come back with more What a Ride after this.
We're back with What a Ride with Rupert Guinness and Aaron Astley. I am Aaron Astley.
I'm Rupert Guinness. Doing my best.
Absolutely, as always. And we are coming to you from the Australian Broadcast Media Network, 36 FM stations via Radio Sydney. We are 200 digital stations. And, of course, we are available download to your smartphone via iTunes. Rupert, great conversation earlier. We probably went a bit long on that first segment, but you know, we started talking Phil Anderson, got to be a little bit of Greg LeMond, and who'd have thunk it? A little Eric Heiden.
Well, you start pulling the heartstrings of history and tradition, and then there you go. You know, you may start talking about the beginning of the earth.
Oh, absolutely. You know what? And, of course, we talk a little bit about cycling and triathlon, and we're going to touch base on snowing and skiing and surfing and surf life-saving at some point. We've touched base on rugby. Well, we talked about the Rugby World Cup earlier. What's going on? You've been covering the rugby all week as well. Anything breaking? Anything we should know about?
Well, some interesting things, because as we're talking now, you know, the rugby season's in the Southern Hemisphere is just coming up to the semi-finals, where we've got four teams, two New Zealand teams, two Australian teams. The Highlanders are playing the... from New Zealand are playing the Waratahs, defending champions, in Sydney on Saturday night, and then also the Hurricanes.
From New Zealand.
And the Hurricanes are going to play the Brumbies, who had a superb win against the Stormers in South Africa last weekend. So you've got two New Zealand sides, two Australian sides in the Super Rugby Championship.
Now talk to me, the Hurricanes, and remind me, they're from Wellington?
No, yeah, Hurricanes from Wellington.
Yeah, exactly. And it's funny you mentioned that.
And the Highlanders are from Dunedin.
Well, the reason I say about the Hurricanes in Wellington, I just wrapped up a feature story for New Zealand Bike Magazine today with one young Scott Ambrose, a 20-year-old cyclist who rides for Team Novo Nordisk. Now, what's special about this team is the entire team is comprised of riders that have type 1 diabetes. Now, Scott Ambrose is a former cyclist turned or triathlete turned road cyclist, and he is a self-admitted, even though he's from Auckland, an avid Hurricanes fan. So that kind of reminded me of that.
Well, good luck to him.
Well, fair enough. Now, we talked about breaking stories.
Because I did laugh.
You did.
But seriously, just to say before you go on to what you're about to say, the Hurricanes have been a superb team, and if they do win the Super Rugby Championship, they deserve it.
You haven't been that. You've been quite supportive of the Hurricanes on lately, but you've been seemingly a bit hard on the Waratahs lately. Really? I haven't seen you banter for them or pick them in the weekly pool.
No, it's not about not picking for. It's funny you mentioned that because there's a former Wallaby who actually had a go at me today about it. And it's not about friggin'. Oh, that's not a swear word.
No, you can say friggin'.
It's not about friggin' being anti Waratah.
Yeah.
Support. It's just not about being a fan. I mean,
yeah. And you're not a fan. You're a journalist.
Really a fan. Yeah. But there are times where I do legitimately think that the Waratahs are not going to win.
Yeah.
And this particular former Wallaby, who did actually captain the Wallabies, I won't get it shorter than that, but he had a respectful dig at, no, not a dig. It was a personal conversation.
Yeah.
He had a go at me about why am I dissing the Waratahs, he said. I said, I'm not dissing the Waratahs, I'm just not a fan. My job as a journalist is not to be a fan, but I also have certain feelings that how they operate as an organisation in the access in allowing personalities of their players to be portrayed in the public media is very restricted. And I'm a big believer that sport, you really need to allow your personalities to come through a team. Okay, there's no I in team, that old cliche.
Yep.
But certainly, you need personalities. In this day and age, you need personalities to shine through. And also, in any team, if a player is put forward, they've got to be able to be confident to say who they are. I mean, they're adults. I mean, for God's sake, these guys are, most of them, are 20 years plus. They're adults. They're not kids. They are human beings who are adults who have opinions, who should be able to say what they think. And in that same sense of maturity, they should be able to sense what they say, maybe, they've got to talk within certain confines of respectability to respect their organisation, as I have to do with, as a journalist at Fairfax Media. I can't be libelous what I write.
You know, you had a chance while you were at the Giro in Europe last month to talk to a lot of people. I mean, obviously, you had a chance to talk to Gregor Brown from Cycling Weekly, the American, and Velo News. We had a chance to talk to, obviously, Andrew Hood. And then, obviously, Alberto Contador's personal attaché.
Yeah, Jacinto.
Yeah, you see how I got out of that.
No.
You're worried.
That was a sick way to meet it. But there's another guy I spoke to in the Giro who I actually first met when he was riding for Lotto. He was riding as a domestique for Cadel Evans. His name is Charlie Vergelius.
Are we talking Cannondale Gorman?
Yes, he is now the sports director there. But you know what? The interesting thing, when I first met Charlie, it was one of those rest day things where you wait, and I was just waiting around to wait for an opportunity to meet the Cadell. It was one of those free-for-alls where you all stand around, and there's journalists standing around, and everyone goes to the main guys. It's a bit like one of those music stops, and then you've got to find a chair. I found Charlie, not a chair. He went, hello. I went, hello.
Is that when you said this last?
Yeah, I said, hello. My name's Rupert. I'm Charlie. He said, we started talking. And then we had a great conversation. This is going back obviously some years when he was riding for Lotto. And then we had a great chat about anything but cycling. It was really amazing. And then he spoke about his love of horses. He trains horses. And, if people don't know who Charlie Vergelius is, he is from Finland. But he also has a British, I could be corrected, there's a British heritage there anyways. So he's half Finnish, half British. And he's written a book on his life as a domestic in cycling. And it's a very interesting book. I can't remember the title. But it's a very interesting book because it's a very honest book. And during this year's Giro, I had a chat to him because in the years that have passed since I first met him, we've always had some fun chats about honesties and mistakes that are made from dress sportifs to journalists. And when we had a chat to him at the Giro, we spoke about his love of, cycling, obviously. His admiration for Ryder Hesjedal.
Oh, Ryder. I have quite an affinity for Ryder Hesjedal.
Yes, as you do know, Aaron, because you did.
A daily diary.
He wrote his daily diary during the Tour Down Under.
I did. And, of course, this was his return back to the Tour Down Under this year. He had not returned to the Tour Down Under since 2012, the same year he won the Giro d'Italia.
Exactly.
And, of course, this year he gave it one red-hot go.
Well, he really did. He came back strong, didn't he?
He did.
I mean, Ryder rode as Ryder does.
Yeah. He proved he's a three-week rider.
Give him
pardon the bun.
He would love 4 weeks.
He'd love 4 weeks.
He would love 3 weeks.
He prefer 4 weeks.
Give me another week. Give me three more mountain stages. I can do this. But unfortunately, the UCI calendar only has so many weeks to accommodate a Grand Tour.
Absolutely.
But
he's so laid back as a Canadian. He doesn't get going until 4 weeks.
Well, that's what Alan Piper said when he won the Giro in 2012. He's so laid back, he's on his back. Alan Piper being an Australian, but I mean,
absolutely.
Alan Piper was floored by Ryder's laid backness. But anyway, Charlie Vergelius gave some pretty interesting insights about Ryder Hesjedal as the fighter. Some interesting anecdotes about through his passion of training horses, him and his wife, they show jump horses. And I asked him, did he see any similarities between the horses he has and the riders that he has? He said there are similarities. And he also said, as we'll hear in this interview, there's a few donkeys as well.
Fantastic. Well, I cannot wait to go to this interview. Let's go now.
I'm with Charlie Vergelius from the Cannondale Garmin team. I'm speaking to Charlie at the Giro d'Italia. We're in the last couple of days before we finish in Milan. It's been a pretty exciting Giro with a lot of unexpected things that have been happening. But I guess, Charlie, that's what the Giro is about.
Yeah, I think the Giro as a race kind of reflects the Italian culture and the Italian way of living. It's exciting and quite unpredictable at times.
You're a rider who had a lot of experience, and obviously you know what the difference is between the Tour and the Giro. How would you describe them, the different characters, but also the different challenges of both races?
Well, I think that if you look at the geography of France, the mountain ranges in France are really very well defined. You've got the Pyrenees and the Alps, and there's usually about 10 days of fairly generic flat riding before that. And it's pretty hard to change that, really. That's always going to be the format of the Tour. But with the mountain ranges in Italy, they can find climbs and hills and challenges behind practically every corner. So there's always something, very close by, and it makes for an exciting race, I think.
Obviously, the way this race has panned out, Alberto Contador showed his hand as arguably the most dominant Grand Tour rider of his generation. Do you agree, or do you think that's been misinterpreted?
No, I think his performance over the years has been pretty impressive, to be honest. And I think at this stage of the race, it's pretty well established that he's the strongest rider here, I think.
Well, speaking of riders, you've got one Ryder Hesjedal, the 2012 winner, who seems to be sort of racing the same manner that he won the Giro with. Can you tell us a bit about Ryder, the rider we don't know about?
he's got his own way of interpreting cycling, you know, and he considers it, I guess, as kind of a distribution of resources, and he really tries to dose out his energy in the less crucial stages, you know, with real precision, and that means he'll often be hanging around at the back of the peloton at times when you wouldn't see other big favourites of the race doing that. But you can see that that comes to fruition in the last week of the race when a lot of people start to run out of energy. He just keeps going. He's a real diesel engine and he's incredibly regular. And, you know, and even when he gets tired, he never really kind of cracks like a lot of riders do, just kind of stop at the side of the road. And he just, even when he's tired, he just keeps plodding on. And in a race like that, that can be really beneficial.
You know, I guess we've seen that already, how he sort of chipped away and chipped away, and he has come back into the race. And I guess no one would ever underestimate what he could do if he was given too much time to get away.
Yeah, I think the way he's raced in the last couple of years, that's also worked against him, because when he goes on breakaways that are genuinely just going after stage wins that wouldn't really need to concern the big favourites of the race, they're very cautious about giving him too much space, because they know that when he gets his nose in the wind and he gets a gap, it's not necessarily so easy to catch him. So that can work against him at times, and I think we saw that yesterday when the peloton only gave him a minute and a half on a stage where normally I think they could have given him 6 to 8 minutes without, you know, being concerned about the overall race.
Now, Charlie, in your days as a rider, you were a domestique, a helper for the leaders. Obviously, that's a huge role. For a general audience that is new to cycling, they see the glamour of the race. They see the guy on the podium, the guy with arms up. They see the particularly with the Tour de France, all the circus of the event, and it's summer and it's nice and everyone's happy, drinking wine on the roadside. But for a domestique, and you've written your book about this as well, what's it really like as a domestique?
It's kind of the coal face of pro cycling, you know. It's where the real hard work's done, and essentially you get given a task that in comparison to your team leader, who falls into the arms of either his masseur or a podium girl, depending on how it's gone, when his finish line is crossed, your finish line for the day as a help rider can be 50, 60, 90 kilometres from the finish line. And then you've got to model your way to the finish somehow and get within the time limit, and that can be pretty grim at times. So they've got a tough job.
Is there one day in the saddle that you were really on the brink, and perhaps to say one day when you're on the brink and you just got through, and maybe one day when you're on the brink and you just didn't have it that day?
I think as far as the Giro is concerned, when we did the Passo Giao in 2008, we rode a really, really hard tempo with the team there to try and split the race. And I was completely empty at the top of that climb, and the race continued, and I had to get to the finish, and it started raining, and I think it was Tre Cimi di Lavoredo, the finish. And it was that climb, it's like something out of the Lord of the Rings, you know, you could expect dragons to come out of some of the hilltops. And I really, I wasn't really sure about how I was going to get to the finish that day, and it was a bit desperate. And that was, so I went from being at the centre of attention at the front of the race, you know, making something happen that hadn't happened in that race until that moment, to being just a bit desperate about trying to get home. So if I would have had 10 pence in my pocket to call my mother that day, I would have done it and asked her to come and pick me up.
Well, I guess from your position as in the team car, as a sports director, you see riders who are on the brink. What do you do to help them, to encourage them, you know, when you think they are on the precipice of abandoning?
Yeah, I think in that position you have to try and hit the balance between sympathy and empathy. Because in that moment, you know, feeling sorry for them isn't going to help them. And you need to use your perspective of where you're sitting to see the things that perhaps they don't see through the fatigue and the tiredness. Because at that moment for them, you know, finding the easy way out can seem the smartest thing to do. Because the brain doesn't necessarily work so well when you're under that kind of stress. And in that moment, the job is to try and get them to realise the smart way and think for them in a way, you know, in a way that hopefully they'll thank you for afterwards.
Now, Charlie, when I first met you, I don't know if you remember, it was when you were riding for Lotto, and it was a rest day, and I was waiting for a press conference with Cadell Evans.
Waiting,
I guess, waiting, a lot of people. And we started talking about anything but cycling. We were talking about your passion and love of horses.
Yeah.
Can you tell us, our audience, a little bit about that and where that's standing at the moment?
Yeah, the horses is a part of my family history through my father, you know, and I find it also with my wife. And I find it a great release from this world. And a relationship with a horse, I think, like any kind of animal, is extremely honest and extremely straightforward. And you kind of... an animal or a horse doesn't have an ulterior motive or any kind of, you know, ambition for anything. And it's so much more simple. And you get what you give. And I find that really refreshing, you know, after... when you work in quite a high-pressure environment at times, to go and spend time with those animals, I find it quite calming.
Your horses, they're show jumpers, aren't they? Or say me if I'm correct, if I'm wrong.
That's right, yeah, they're show jumpers, yeah.
And what sort of standard of show jumping, or is it not the standard you look for? It's just to sort of, as you said, to be with and share that experience with the horses.
My wife jumps, she's taking a pause now because she's had kids, but she was jumping 140 centimetres, which is a kind of good hobby level, I guess. But it's not something we have a huge ambition with. It's just it's more about the process, I think.
Where are the horses? Where's your stable or the farm or the land where they're at?
They're up at home in Finland. My wife's family, they have a dairy farm, so we kind of piggyback on the back of that.
Are there any good horses in the peloton? You've got to tell me that.
Yeah, there's some good young ones, and there's some good stayers, and there's also a few donkeys, I have to admit, but that gets sorted at the end of every year when they have your contract negotiations.
Okay, Charlie McGillis, thank you very much for your time, for joining us on What a Ride, and we'll chat during the Tour de France, obviously, we'll touch in to see how you're doing and how Garmin Cannondale are doing. Thanks very much.
It'll be a pleasure, thank you.
Roo, fantastic interview with Charlie. You know what, even talking to show jumping, it dates me back to having some interviews with Edwina Topps Alexander, who is an Australian legend in the sport of show jumping. It just goes to show you that cycling, show jumping, triathlon, it all blends, doesn't it?
It actually tore my heartstrings when I went to pony camp. I said to Charlie, I told him, I said, I went to pony camp once. You know what? I actually won a ribbon. He said, what for?
Participation.
He said something between what and for. It was like an F word.
Yeah.
I said, well, for being... having it go, it was like they had one ribbon left over.
So basically, it's what I said, is participation.
Yes, patience. Well, yeah. I was on a pony who didn't even move.
And it's an amazing sport, but to hear him talk about not just that, but obviously Ryder Heijndal, and you know, it's fantastic.
Yeah. I mean, what's interesting is to see that. Charlie's a obviously, you know, major player with how he wants his team to run, to try and win races. But at the same time, I admire his faith in someone like Ryder Heijndal. Just the, you got to let Ryder race as Ryder races.
Yeah.
You know what? And it may not win you a Grand Tour. It may not, you know, it may not win you a stage. But one thing I did see in the Giro, it got your team up the front at the end, and Ryder still, he was a protagonist. He was a protagonist in the race.
And in full disclosure, Ryder has had some negative press over the years. We acknowledge that here at What a Ride. He has had some issues. He's confessed.
No, he's confessed to his doping past.
Yeah, back in his mountain biking days. And I think a lot of people forget that Ryder is a three-time Olympian already, and he went to the Olympics as a mountain bike rider originally. And there could be aspirations for Rio as well, because maybe it is. Maybe we could say this. Maybe Canada doesn't have a lot of major pro cyclists they're churning out. He could still be a next big thing. But with Ryder, he even took this year. He was one of the riders that was actually, you know, their bike was taken in and looked for a motor.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, for the motor. Yeah. Actually, that's the other
thing. And with Alberto Contador.
Yeah. I mean, that's the other issue, you know, bike doping, which will be I mean, it was an issue that became apparent in, not apparent, it became an issue that came up in the Giro d'Italia, and I've no question or doubt it'll be an issue that it'll appear in the Tour de France, because these issues tend to appear in the big name events. But actually, I know some people will say that how the UCI are reacting to the potential issue of bike doping is a wrong thing. I don't disagree with that, because I actually think if there's an opportunity to try and be on top of something before it happens, why not get on top of it? And okay, doping, like it's human doping, blood doping, or whatever, all those issues still have to be addressed. And getting on top of potential bike doping, if it exists, I don't think should be seen as a blanket to the other issues. But I just think if there's an opportunity to try and be proactive rather than reactive, go for it. And I'm not against the UCI for trying to be proactive in that front. Obviously, still saying we still have to address the issue of doping reactively.
Absolutely. In all fairness to Ryder, they did test his bike along with Alberto Contador. And again, I forget the stage. I'm sure our listeners will remind us on Twitter or Facebook. But the fact is the very next day he actually pulled, and the bikes were cleared, they were fine.
Yeah, exactly.
And the very next day he actually pulled off one of his better results.
Exactly. So, and
that's Ryder Heijndal. That's Ryder Heijndal.
Ryder Rides.
Yeah, Ryder Rides for sure.
That's what he does.
Yeah. I tell you what, one of the best weeks ever in my career spent with you guys, Tour Down Under this year.
I just think you referred to that about the Tour Down Under when he came down. I mean, okay, I know in other Tour Down Unders, other riders would come down and have a coffee and stuff, but what was interesting, Ryder was actually the first guy to actually, cyclist to come down and, he was doing the diary with you. But he actually came down and made it like something he was not a labour.
Yeah.
He actually enjoyed it.
Yeah.
And then I've got to say, what I found was interesting, you were doing your diary place, and then I was there.
You were right in front of me.
I was in front of you, but I was actually right on the deadline.
I know.
And
so I'd apologise for that.
No, that was interesting, because it was actually a chance for. I thought this is a chance to maybe see that, okay, well, I might have had a wine glass.
Well, because you,
right.
And fair enough.
But I wasn't a deadline, and I wasn't able to partake in the conversational aspect of it. And
for the record, the bar is open at 5.
Yeah. I just thought, you know what, this is a chance, at least for a bike rider, to see that I had to write a story. I was under the pump. I wasn't able to engage.
I think we had a good time. I think it was a pleasure.
The wine glass next to me gave it away.
What was amazing, though, is by the end of the week, we could be shooting ourselves in the foot, because they may all hear this and not give us this respect next year. But at one point, I think we had Walter Whippet from Draft Pack, Steel Von Hoff, who was the reigning two-time Criterium champion. He had just made the transition from Garmin Sharp to NFTO. We had both Ryder and obviously Nathan there from Cannondale Garmin, and we even had Richie Port coming down.
Yeah, and he went home. He went back to his bed because
he was
ready for a big season.
He did.
One thing, the last thing, actually, what you make is a very good point, because one of my big gripes about football, rugby union, which I cover
accessibility
the Morning Herald, is as we spoke about before, about the lack of access to players and athletes, and how it's so important for the media to have some sense of the personality of the athlete, whether they're a cyclist, a footballer, or whatever. And we can say we're a friggin' big believer that unless the journalists can have an opportunity to understand the person, not the athletes who's put before the television grab, for a quick 1 minute quote, 2 minute quote, or the supposed exclusive, extensive 5 minute interview. If you're a respected journalist, okay, some people may say they're not respected journalists. I just think if I'm not a respected journalist, I like to think that any respected journalist may get a crack at being able to have at least an hour as an extensive interview.
I'll tell you off air whether you're respected or not. I'll tell you off air.
Thank you for that. I was going to tell you on the air.
No, just please hold that response. I agree with you completely, and you're absolutely right. And, And as that accessibility, obviously pro cycling, even the sport of triathlon, the endurance sports, running, surfing, surf lifesaving, snowboarding, skiing. As they grow in popularity, that accessibility is starting to diminish. I hope not, for our own sake, so we don't have to work so hard to get interviewed. But more importantly, they are some great sports. The reason why we connect with these guys so much and the reason we love it. You know, we've had one hell of a show again this year. It's episode 3. We've got another one coming next week before you head off to the Tour de France. I go to China for the Tour of Qinghai Lakes. Exactly. So we're all happening on the road. Next week, we're going to save it. We're going to try to fit it in this week. We got an interview with Dan Jones, the man behind Backstage Pass. He is Mr. Backstage Pass.
Yeah, he. I thought you were going to say something else. Dan would actually laugh at what I won't go down that path. But anyway.
I don't know Dan, so I won't go there.
Dan Jones has been, you know, he was the creator, the instigator, the guy who created Backstage Pass for the Orica Green Edge team. And when that team started, one of the most important things that I know that Jerry Ryan, the owner, wanted was that the team would have a multimedia focus, but not just in a computerized sense or whatever. He wanted that to be a personalized sense. He wanted the punter to feel a part of the team. He wanted the punter to ride the journey with the team. And really important for that was for Dan Jones, to, you know, who's got a very strong background in, you know, production and film work and a personality that he can just sort of embed himself into a team without actually imposing himself. And he's very conscious of that as well. So that's part of a lot of why what he has done has been very successful. So that was very much one of Jerry Ryan's mandates in this team starting. Jerry didn't want a team to start and just be a team. He wanted to have a team that had the staff, the riders, sponsors, supporters, but the supporters who feel...
A community connection,
mm-hmm. exactly, Aaron. Yeah. Community connection.
But does that go back to Jerry's, and we'll talk about this on next week's show, but does that come back to Jerry's background with rugby, even? Right? He owns the Melbourne Storm. He's got a background with theater, and obviously Walking with the Dinosaurs and War Horse. We've seen him with the Melbourne Cup and horse racing with Americane. And he comes from a more public-dominated background. And, of course, obviously, he's most known for being the CEO and president of Jago Caravans, which is all about engaging people to get out on the road and see the world.
Exactly. And Jerry knows how it works. And when he has something, I say it works, it's not in a cynical way. It's just that Jerry has an understanding of what's required. Anybody who's met Jerry knows, he's a guy. Jerry Ryan is obviously a very busy person, big, high-powered business person, but he does have a human attachment to people's... I would actually even say I know firsthand certain people who he's actually helped very privately, which hasn't been publicised. But he's also had a bigger vision to just trying to support associations, community sports. And he does. Well, I'll put an interview for next week anyway, which I did with Jerry just a couple of days ago.
Fantastic.
About Orica Green Edge and how they're tracking and his vision for where they will track. And it's like a open-ended question.
Rupert, always a pleasure. With Rupert Guinness and Aaron Eslie, we are again live at the Lord Dudley.
They're calling us, aren't they? Our song's calling us soon, isn't it?
It is.
I'm worried about what it is, though.